Christmas time is here. Happiness and cheer. Fun for all, the children call their favorite time of year. Snowflakes in the air. Carols everywhere.
Hooray, hurrah, and Christmas greetings. Nancy Wilson sings to us from the big holiday in the sky. She's swirling all around Vince Guaraldi's awesome hit from the believable album, A Nancy Wilson Christmas, which is what we're having this year. We'll get to Nancy Wilson later and her immortality that precedes her. One of the great rhythm and blues, soul and jazz artists that this country's ever produced in an extraordinary 50-year career and a billion albums. Hi, hooray, hurrah, the smartest man on the world, Proofcast takes the ether, this time from the fortress of Proofacood, located right here in the porcress. I've had both my eyes out in the last week, my left eye last week, my right eye this week. So I'm in those awkward in-between years where I can't really see. I have a pair of glasses, that kind of which I haven't had since I was 7 years old. I can sort of see in the middle distance, but I have to take them off to see anything close. So I'm walking around bumping into anything. Jennifer's here.
Hello, but you have a Santa hat on.
I do have a Santa hat on, and it has a leopard trim, so I'm as chic as I can possibly be. And we're having a good time here in the Porpoise of Fruititude, or the Pugress of Truticude, or whatever I just bloody well called it here. We're taking to the sky to once again join hands and join hearts in this burning cinder of a Yule log, or a Duraflame log, and find some solace in one another's company here. Let's jump right in, shall we? We've missed so much in the last week, but I wanted to talk about a couple of awesome things that have happened since the last time we met. First of all, I wanted to go back, if we may, in time, as Huey Lewis in the News once suggested, and talk a little bit about Nancy Pelosi and that meeting last week. Now, we didn't talk about it in the show last week, did we?
No. You mean where she slayed?
Yeah. The meeting with Chuck Schumer, Orange 45, Mike Pence sat rapt with his eyes closed, rocking back and forth gently with his tie hanging down under his coat like he had just come back from an eighth grade sort of hayride. Schumer didn't look. They formed a triangle as Nancy gazed directly upon Orange 45. Orange 45 tried to yell down everyone in the room, and Schumer sort of gazed off into the distance past Nancy. So they double-teamed him. But the point was, after they came out of the meeting and completely flummoxed him by using facts and whatnot, this was, if you recall, about a week ago. Now, so much has happened since then. There's been Cohen and Flynn and Butina. So many indictments flying. We've withdrawn from Syria because we've beaten ISIS. There's been so much good news. We've banned lynching federally, finally. So many things have happened. It's been an avalanche of goodness. But if you'll remember one short week ago, Nancy Pelosi, with her trim ankles sitting erect, eviscerated him with facts, Orange 45, that is, and then strode onto the pitch right to the lectern. Chuck has that kind of hunchy sort of NYU professor thing going on, where his glasses are perched at the end of his nose, and he seems avuncular and caring and yet unable to get the waiter's attention at the
bar. He's always grading papers.
Right? I'm going to have to give you a B- on this. I loved your intention on this, but I just think your work was... I'm always afraid he can't get the bar staff's attention.
Cafe Lou.
Right? He seems to me like the kind of person who... you're going to sit there a long time until you get the check because Chuck's unable to get that. Whereas Nancy would have already sent word to the kitchen and the chef's already come out and talked to the whole table.
Yes.
And made something special for you, like a scallop dish that they've had in abeyance. Maybe I'm wrong on this. Maybe Chuck's super, super awesome in person. I've met Amy, and I know Amy's related to him. Am I pouring liquid all over my computer screen?
No, you're fine.
Oh, okay. difficult for me to ascertain at this point. And so she came out, and she was wearing this coat, and I wanted to read you a little piece from, I think this is the New York Times. Nancy Pelosi's coat catches fire is the headline. It's the boldest political piece of political outerwear since the other coat. And then there's a photograph of them striding out there. You may remember it's an orange sort of mid-length jacket, mid-calf, I would say.
Burnt orange.
Burnt orange, with a high collar and... sort of a high shoulders, very military style. There's no epaulets.
Not military style. What? I would say it was kind of a very classic 60s cut.
Formidable, though. I mean, yes. There's
it
an
made
edifice.
A statement.
Yeah. I mean, she came out in heels in that.
She took his erongitude and made it hers.
Right.
After she smote him.
She borrowed his erongitude, which was mm-hmm. just astonishing. Let's see here. Nancy Pelosi tossed on like a victor's cloak. The funnel-necked piece of outerwear Nancy Pelosi tossed on like a victor's cloak after exiting her contentious meeting. I wouldn't say it was contentious. I would say it was a lopsided victory. If there was any contention, it was the fact that 45 kept screaming they were going to build a wall. I have the votes for the wall. I'm going to – Congress will easily vote for the wall. And Nancy Pelosi at one point went, then do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then said to him at one point, you don't have the votes for the wall. Are you sure we haven't discussed this before? In any case, dark glasses, sharp heels, and a smile of post-combat exhilaration. The coat whispered burn with a wink and a swish. I don't know. I thought the coat shouted, I dominated you.
Yes.
I don't know about a wink and a swish. I thought, as you said, the coat purloined his longitude and reconstituted it back to him. She also said to him, don't characterize the strength that I bring, when he said Nancy doesn't want to talk about this. So she completely owned her own gigantic victory. And by her own gigantic victory, I mean the victory of 100 women being elected to the House and her reanointment and reappointment as what will certainly be Speaker of the House again come January.
Also, she's third in line.
Oh, yeah.
After the sleepy guy and the shouty guy.
Mm. When shouty guy and sleepy guy get indicted, our Nancy might be, well, she's certainly third in line for president again. Let's see here. It didn't take long for the coat to get its own Twitter handle, Nancy Coat, and then it got another AM coat. It was some speculation the designer was Carolyn Herrera. It's not. The right answer is Max Mara. The coat's no longer available except as a reseller, but it is now. They've re-put it mm-hmm. out again, so you can go on Max Mara's site.
Because I think women saw it as a power coat, which is beautiful. That would be why it would be reissued as a symbol of power for women.
I agree, and I think it was so strong and so tremendously pointed and poignant. 45 wears those long ties and the terrible, terrible big shoulders and the droopy, non-fitting coats and the baggy pants. And the pantser always wears... his body's awful and his lower body's terrible. He has that kind of police, you know, like...
Oh, it's ghastly.
Yeah, you know, like sort of shambly body. And he always, he has his coat too tight and his tie sticking out below, which I hate on television. Like, I have spent my whole life trying to hide the bottom part of the tie from sticking out like that because it looks ghastly.
Well, also, it may seem shallow to talk about fashion to this extent, but everything is a symbol. Everything is a message. A red baseball cap. Is a trigger.
Potent.
Yeah.
I don't think it's shallow at all.
It makes me think of what we were talking about before with the Cambridge Analytica whistleblower, Christopher Wiley, was at a conference in England this week. And he said about how Cambridge Analytica was looking at data of how people shop online and what people wore. And he said, the shame, the colonialism, the racial biases, the toxic masculinity, the fat shaming that the fashion industry puts out and has been putting out for decades is exactly what Cambridge Analytica sought to exploit when they were seeking to undermine people and manipulate them. And also, the underlying danger is the unchecked power of technology. Companies mining our personal data, said Wiley. Silicon Valley sees the internet as terra nova, he explained, likening tech giants such as Facebook to conquerors. Those companies are not our saviors. They are seeking to colonize us. Facebook is the new East India Company of the internet.
That's an extraordinary statement to make. Both of those things. One, of course, the fat shaming and talking about how preying on people's insecurities, their weaknesses. We're all too fat. We're all too this. We're all too old. We're all too, my hair's not the right color. My face isn't the right shape. I wish I could lose weight. I'm not perfect. I'm not perfect. I'm not perfect. When everybody knows, as Oscar Wilde said, your imperfections are what makes you unique. Your weaknesses are your strengths. I've been told an entire lifetime that I'm too gay, that my voice is too this, that I'm too effeminate, blah, blah, blah. I wouldn't have a life or a career, or any distinct personality, were it otherwise. Not to bring it back to me, but I'm saying everyone has to take this on in their own way. And two, calling it Terra Nova is a really profound thing. the East India Company was such a powerful entity that from the 1600s onward, they had a private army and a private navy that worked not at the behest of the crown, but in conjunction with the crown, and had to be curtailed and brought under the aegis of the crown and privatized in the 19th century after the giant wars in India in the middle of the 19th century. Until then, it was called John Company by the people who worked for it, and they had their own private armies, and they were colonizing and raping and pillaging the entire Southeast Asia, obviously the subcontinent of India, the colonies in North America and the Caribbean, whatnot, and Canada, and obviously America up till the revolution. Well, they thought it was their right to exploit. Terra Nova means the new land.
Mm-hmm. Right now, their effects are, I mean, they're seen in so many places, but I'm thinking of Burma, Myanmar.
Mm.
That is the product of the boundaries of that country, or the product of the East India Company.
So most certainly. And the adjunct companies that took over the Middle East, that administered the Middle East up until the 19th century, and Africa, are still those borders, I think, are remnants of that. And the fact that they had to be made to basically be part, absorbed into the British government, and that the British government was willing to allow give them that gigantic charter for hundreds and hundreds of years to exploit things, mm-hmm. and pay their tithing to the crown and all that. Well, not unlike Spain or Portugal or Holland, but certainly the analogy is not lost that it's time to rein in Google and Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Which is what's so exciting about the Attorney General of D.C., Carl Racine, is today announcing he's suing Facebook for allowing Cambridge Analytica to access data from millions of users. The documents were acquired by the British Parliament in their investigation. It's interesting to note that Carl Racine was an associate White House counsel to Bill Clinton, and that he was born in Haiti, and he moved to D.C. as a kid. So how profound that he would come to our rescue.
And he's the AG of D.C., is it?
Yes. He's 54, I think.
It's also not lost on me that he's African-American.
Right.
The tech companies in their homogeneity are relentlessly white, relentlessly ageist, and relentlessly sexist. They tend to really be white guys in their 20s and 30s. And when you reach a certain age, you're done. They don't love to have women write code. There's very few women who sit on the boards, and there's very few people of color. Having said that, you saw the the CEO of,
oh my God.
I can't even get it out. If anyone watched the hearing last week, the CEO of Google got up, and evidently the people in our Senate are so unfamiliar with tech that at one point, one of the senators said, my iPhone, there was a bad incident, and the CEO of Google went, Google doesn't make the iPhone. He didn't know that Google was a search engine, and he didn't know that the iPhone was made by Apple. That's unclear. But then again, you have people like Chuck Grassley and Louis Gohmert and John King and Kennedy and Corbyn. And I just made that up. I threw in Corbyn. It's Cornyn.
Not Jeremy.
They're wildly uneducated and wildly untech savvy. I think that, you and I, that's partly why you and I agree so much. Dressing is absolutely emblematic of everything, and everything is a signifier.
Yes.
A red baseball cap means one thing now, and that it didn't mean before.
And the white polo shirt means you're a neo-Nazi,
mm-hmm.
in
khaki pants,
Bill.
A tiki torch.
Mm-hmm.
A pussy hat. There's a million, or
and you have to be aware of that. You can't discount that what you're wearing is a uniform, no matter what it is.
No, and
that you have to own it, and you have to be aware of it, and what it might mean to other people.
To be even more explanatory about it, the this, the whole eighth grade barn dance, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Cracker Barrel way of dressing, that Huckabee bad tie, loose fitting 90s, we're out of touch thing, mm-hmm. is definitely,
it's calculated
and sending a message to the mm-hmm. people that it's supposed to mean something to, the people who feel uncomfortable being oppressed by sophisticated people, the people that they feel are that the elites are crushing them, that intellectuals and people from sophisticated places are taking up too much of their emotional time and space, that they're forcing homosexuality and sophistication on them, and all those things that they see as the enemy. Whereas I think you see someone like Mr. Trudeau in Canada, or Monsieur Macron in Paris, or Ms. Merkel in Germany, and you see how they dress. They're tied down. They look really professional. Macron and Trudeau are enormously fit and young. Mm-hmm. They're both in their early 40s, and they look like they run a lot, and they keep it together. They're not, you know, chunky older men. They don't have that William Howard Taft thing going on. They have that JFK thing going on, or the RFK thing going on. You're sexy with good hair. And then Angela Merkel's got that redoubtable statesperson mm-hmm. thing going on, because she's so intelligent and so pulled together. And then Putin's got that creepy, you know, a bad cop thing, that bad cop look mm-hmm. that he does with the bad facelift and the horrible eyes.
I always think of that, the exhibit that we saw in London of dictators when they were young.
Mm.
And there was a photo of him as maybe a 10-year-old.
Yes.
With a faraway kind of hateful glance.
Yeah.
And he looked exactly the same.
That was when I'm sure he was torturing animals and, mm. you know, the things that they do. Well, you know, Duarte works that, you know, that classic Marcos Noriega thing where you wear the untucked shirt, the sunglasses, and the I'm the tropical dictator. I've got a, you know, I'm heedless of everyone's feelings, police state. I chop heads off. I'm summary.
The Orange 45 tower decor just screams Ceausescu.
Oh, doesn't it? It's so Orban in Hungary, that tastelessness.
Who was the Ukrainian?
Yanukovych or whatever his name was.
Who had the ship and the fantasy land and the people wouldn't, after he was deposed, people went to go visit it.
Oh yes, I can't.
Who was that?
It was Yanukovych. Well, we'll come back to that. Yeah, and he had like a Peter Pan land of
funny,
castles.
Funny how they have the same taste
or lack of.
Yes.
No, everything's like Graceland.
Right. When you hate other people, you gravitate to that look.
All of a sudden, you've got a gold ceiling and terrible chests of drawers with gilt on them, and blue vases,
and a lot of ostrich leather jackets,
right? And portraits of yourself.
Oh, what about that? Barbara Underwood,
the Trump Foundation,
yeah, brought down the Trump Foundation, and she gets to decide where the money goes, which is
just sensational.
Just wonderful.
Really keeping evil at abeyance. It's an extraordinary moment in American legal history. A sitting, and I hesitate to use the word, but let's call him a leader, shall we? A sitting person who's in office, having his entire charity not only taken away from him, but the rights to what happens with the funds from that charity being given over to the state of New York's legal team so that they will decide where it's apportioned. It's never happened before. Like what's been going on with the collaborating with the Russians. I hate the word collusion. Like what's been going on with Maria Butina.
Conspiracy.
Like what's been going on with this conspiracy with Flynn, Cohen, and the now the famous Giuliani. We didn't sign an affidavit saying we were going to meet with the Russians. Oh, we did sign an affidavit. We know now that they've been collaborating with them and conspiring with them. Collusion is a weird word. It's a spongy, amorphous word. Conspiracy and collaboration are more to the key. These are all unprecedented crimes that are at the highest level of... go ahead.
By the way, Barbara Underwood, she took over from Schneiderman, who was forced out.
And for being a pervert.
Yes. She's only been the New York State Attorney General since May.
Yes.
She's gotten so much done.
Right. And then now Tish Campbell, is it?
Tish James.
I gave her a different name. I gave her the name of a singer. I gave her Tish Campbell's name. Tish James, Letitia James, Ms. Letitia James will take over for her next month. Barbara Underwood is a real bloody hero. Just to go back and finish this off here with Nancy Pelosi. She wore that coat before once at Obama's second inauguration. She knew the meeting would be televised.
That was beautiful, too. That that was sending a message.
It was right. It was no coincidence. Let's see. Ms. Pelosi wore a lavender suit to lead her troops to the healthcare vote in 2010 and bright blue when she won the leadership nomination last month. You may remember that our Hills wore red, white, and blue. Mm-hmm. And on the night she was nominated for the first woman nominated to run for president, she
suffrage.
Wore... Yeah, white, which was the color of suffrage.
Yes.
And her mother and my mother were born in the same year, 1919, and were born before women, white women had the right to vote in the United States. So all of these are really highly symbolic, and I'll have it no other way, and I don't think Jennifer will either. A trucker cap means something. A gun patch means something. Your tie means something. And I don't mean just class and symbols of status. When I wear a suit and tie, to me, it's not a matter of a symbol of status. You've taught me over the years that dressing up is a matter of respect for yourself and for the people that you're meeting and dealing with. This is something that was never lost on people who aren't white people who, as Don Rickles so brilliantly said before he passed, wear their pajamas to the show. Now, I understand why white people feel so comfortable with it.
Well, I always think of, if I may...
Jump in.
When I got to meet James Brown at the airport...
Please, expand on this story, won't you? I think everyone will enjoy this story.
I happen to have been wearing a thrift
store...
No.
You have to go back a little bit further.
What?
Just set the scene a little bit. You don't just start with, I met James Brown at the airport.
No. Well, I was there early in the morning. I was by myself. I had gone to visit a friend in Paris, and it was 89? 90? Greg was doing Whose Line in London, and I got a chance to see my friend from San Francisco in Paris. And the clothes that I had were either from Lip Service on Melrose or from a thrift store. But I happened to be wearing, I had a carry-on and I was wearing almost everything that I brought, which was a cape from a thrift store that was like a 60s cape, a blue velvet jacket.
The cape was velvety too.
Velvet, no, it was black.
Black. You were wearing a cape in the
black
morning.
Black velvet leggings. It was 8:30 in the morning and I was wearing Chelsea boots. And I didn't feel ridiculous in that ensemble.
Well, not in Paris.
And, Parisians are conservative in their dress. But anyway, so I'm sitting there by myself, and James Brown appears. He's the first off his flight. There's no one around. And so I thought, well, I have to seize this moment. And I jumped up and I went over and I shook his hand.
May I ask what James Brown was wearing, please?
It was sort of similar
what
to what
like?
I was wearing.
Start to the hair.
The reason I bring it up was he was sort of wearing what I was wearing.
Did he have a cape on?
He wasn't wearing a cape. He was wearing a matador jacket.
Thank you.
High-waisted trousers, Chelsea boots.
Right.
And
blue?
A satin blouse, and I was wearing a satin blouse. So
did he have a Marcel or a giant bouffant?
There were a lot of curls.
Yeah.
And he was...
8 in the morning.
Oh, like full hair and makeup.
Oh, and they'd been up since 6, I'm guessing.
Yeah. And he came over to me because he assumed the way I was dressed that I was there to meet him.
Yeah.
And I asked him if I could just shake his hand. And we talked, and then his entourage got off the plane. And... there was no one around, and finally a French guy, a young guy, came over and asked him if he could have an autograph. And James Brown looked at him and then looked at me and said, "No, but you can shake my hand," and smiled at me.
Wow.
It was cool. And then I got on the plane, and there was so much cologne on that plane.
How much cologne?
Oh my God.
Did your eyes burn?
It was kind of hilarious.
As you once said to me, turbo brute.
Yeah, yeah. It was intense. But I've never been happier to have happened to be wearing a cape at 8:30 in the morning at an airport, which is, this is a long way to go to say, don't ever be embarrassed to dress how you want to dress and dress up and take care with how you look. You know, I think I bought the cape for $3. We're not talking like, you know.
No, I agree. The thing about when you're overdressed is you're never overdressed when you're overdressed. I remember going to a playoff game in the 80s with my roommate Dennis, and he'd come from a gig and he was wearing a tuxedo. I remember going to basketball games at the Warriors, and I would say to the guys I would go with, suit and tie. And we'd wear suit and ties to the basketball game. And then you often, when I would go with Warren Thomas, our good buddy, I would be dressed in a suit and tie, and he would be wearing his usual outfit. He dressed like Mac 10, which was Timberland boots, jeans, and a flannel shirt and a baseball hat. And we'd walk in together, and I'd say, let me go first. And we would walk right down into the front, and no one would stop us. The power of it is pretty wild. Also, like you say,
it's got to be fun, too.
The respect of it, you know.
Well, I always think of jazz musicians. How do they dress? I mean, Ron Carter.
Ron Carter. When you went up to Ron Carter, we went to see Ron Carter this year. And Jennifer, we after the show, it was at a small joint here in Los Angeles called the Catalina, which is really nice. They have kind of okay food and a beautiful atmosphere, like, you know, really intimate. And Ron Carter plays at a perfect level of volume. Like, it's so, it's just loud enough. It's not loud. It's tasteful. And it's piano, hollow body guitar, and bass. And beautiful, all standards. And they all wear two dye suits with pocket squares. And beautiful, it's white shirts all around, and shiny shoes.
Oh, yes.
And Ron Carter is 6.5 feet tall and most elegant. So we go up after the gig, and they play Funny Valentine, and they play They'll Never Be Other. All this just really lovely. And Ron Carter's available after the show. He's hanging. And Jennifer goes, Mr. Carter, you're so smart and elegant and funny and great, and he pretends to write it down with it like an emotion, like a pad on his hand, and then he goes, tell me about it. And that made me but like, they look smashing. Well, when we saw Herbie Hancock play, the suit Herbie Hancock was wearing,
the
was
dignity and you know, being having that refined kind of look, ironing your clothes and taking care and just
Miles Davis
feeling it. I think that when we saw Ron Carter that night, Miles Davis's first wife Frances, who was a Broadway star, was there, and I think that was the beautiful thing about when you catch these people in jazz clubs now. There are people, special people, who she was a dancer and a performer, and I don't think Miles Davis let her continue her career.
Oh, his wife?
Right. She was there that night.
Yeah, she was.
She was on a couple of his album covers.
Yes.
But she was there to hang out with Ron Carter, and that's what's cool, too, about going to see these performers, is you don't know who might be in the audience, too.
Well, as I recall, the night I wasn't there and you went, everybody was there.
every bass
basically
player.
Basically, every musician, right.
I happened to get seated with John B. Williams, who,
right.
And I mentioned to him, and I don't know why, but I mentioned to him that about Bob Crenshaw, who is a bass player who had just passed away. It turned out Bob Crenshaw was John B. Williams's mentor and had got him a gig on, of all things, Sesame Street.
Well, Crenshaw had the gig for what, like 15 years?
Well, and Crenshaw, I think he's one of those bass players that's on everything. If you look
right,
him
like
up,
Ron Carter, like 2,000 records.
Has a phenomenal career, as does John B. Williams.
Commercials, TV shows, Tonight Show band.
Jazz clubs, yeah.
Wasn't he in Doc Severinsen's band and shit? And,
John B. Williams was...
He was in the Carson's band, wasn't he?
No. Later. He was on... I'm going to have to look this up.
That's all right. Well, suffice to say, they gigged constantly. And it was everything.
But what
including
a delight,
Sesame Street.
What a delight. He was... John B. Williams was in Horace Silver's band. And
never heard of it.
Really? He studied with Ron Carter.
Surprise.
And, you know, the beautiful thing is these guys are... 80 and they're still around. Yeah, he was in the Tonight
yeah,
Show
I'm
band.
I'm not wrong.
He was the so he was the in the house band of the Arsenio Hall show. Too.
Arsenio
that's what
Hall,
I was thinking
that's the
about.
You were right. I knew he was in the Tonight Show.
But he told me he would not have gotten any of that if Bob Crenshaw hadn't said, "Look, I have to do a studio gig. Do you want to sit in for me on Sesame Street?" It was totally not done, and he said to me, like, he showed up, and the other musicians are like,
"Who are you?
Who? What are you doing
Bob,
here?
Bob, who sent you what?"
Right, and he just, like, you know, snuck in there,
right.
And like, that's it. And he
fortunately,
was so great.
I can read charts, and yeah. I'm as good as Bob. So here we go.
Yeah.
And he ended up keeping that gig how long? He was in the Sesame Street band for 20 years or something?
Right, but I just got to sit with him at the jazz club at Catalina and hear his story, and it was, you know, it was fascinating and amazing.
And all the other cats came over and to talk to him, too.
Yes.
And that other cat whose dad was a big band leader.
Right.
And all the other bass players.
Right, the other person at the table, his grandparents were in the house orchestra at MGM, and then
right.
They had become, his grandparents had become part of Frank Sinatra's
that's right.
touring group.
And then,
was
it Miles?
Randomly, these were my table mates.
Yeah, I know. You had a grand night. Well, that's the thing. As we always say, you've got to go out and see people, and you've got to go out and see them now. I never got to see Nancy Wilson. I saw her on telly, of course.
The other day, we were listening to Ramsey Lewis, who's still touring, and I believe he's 80.
See. Yeah.
And he met Nancy Wilson, I think, in the early 60s, and they hit it off, and she became... godmother to his children.
Let's spin a little Nancy Wilson, shall we? Nancy Wilson, I'm going to read you a little bit from the Jim Farber wrote an obit for the New York Times. But before I read that, Jennifer sent me another article about her, and I thought it had one of the great lines in it. It was from an LA Times review from the Coconut Grove gig that she did in the early 60s. And she killed it so hard at the Grove in Los Angeles that the critic said they gave her everything but the deed to the building. And I thought, that's a review. Because Nancy Wilson was a rare mixture of style, class, and soul. She was able to swing it. She's also a great jazz singer, obviously, but obviously a great soul singer and pop singer as well.
Mm-hmm.
She had a television show when we were kids, the same time as Flip Wilson. Flip Wilson's show ran from 70 to 75, and hers, I think, was 73, 74, mm-hmm. called The Nancy Wilson Show. She was also a frequent guest on everyone else's show, as she often wore a really swinging gown and high heels.
She was glamorous.
Really glamorous.
And I remember what Ramsey Lewis said, that what struck him when he first met her was she was really laid back, and she had a great sense of humor.
Right? Right? Here's one that they did together. Our Ramsey's still alive, by the way, and our Nancy lives forever. Do we know who wrote this?
Peel me a grape. Crush me some ice, skim me a peach, leave the fuzz for my pillow, start me a smoke, talk to me nice. You got a whiny and nine me. Don't try.
I want to say it's her.
Me. Bejewel me. Either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry.
Unerring sense of taste and refinement.
French me a fry.
Unfailing phrasing.
Me a nut. Bring a bowl full.
No cloying. No. No overreaching. She's the epitome of class and style. She's a stylist without any affectation. She's a force of nature. She's someone who made 50 records. She's someone who collaborated with every great jazz artist and pop artist of her era. She's someone who appreciated every style of music. She's singular, I think, in a lot of ways. And another thing, she was enormously popular. In the early 60s, there was a time when Nancy Wilson was an unstoppable force at Capitol Records. Yeah. And people don't want to the fact that she had a television show when they weren't giving black women jazz singers television shows as much as they might says quite a lot about her perspicaciousness, her alacrity, her ability to perform on television as a sketch artist, a personality, and the amazing breadth and scope of her humanity as an artist. She was really able to do it all.
She was a civil rights activist, too.
Oh, she's extraordinary. Like, let's see here. In a long and celebrated career, Ms. Wilson performed American standards, jazz ballads. Let's see. I Have a Gift for Telling Stories and Make Them Seem Larger Than Life. Kenny's signature piece. Yeah, she did was a civil rights activist as well. She was inducted into the International Civil Rights Walk of Fame in 2005. As an artist, taking a political stand came with professional risks, but it had to be done. She was born in Chillicothe, Ohio. Six children. Her dad was a supervisor at an iron foundry. Her mother was a maid. Her father played Nat King Cole, Billy Eckstein, and Jimmy Scott. So much of my phrasing is similar to Jimmy Scott's, she says, right? By the time she was 10, she was lead singer in the local choir. No formal training. She worshipped Dinah Washington.
Well, rightly so.
We all worship Dinah Washington. Let's spin one off the Cannonball Adderley album. This is one that a lot of jazz fans talk about a lot. I'm going to, let's see, we'll play Save Your Love for Me. Save Your Love for Me off the Cannonball Adderley, 62. She was signed by John Levy. She worked with George Shearing, and she went to Capitol.
Why I'm so in love with you, no one else in this world will do. Darling, please save your love for me. Run away. If I were wise, I'd run away. But like a fool in love, I stay. And pray you'll save your love for me. I can feel it, even when you're not here, can't conceal it. I really love you, my dear, and though I know no good can come from loving you, I can't do a thing. I'm so in love with you. So darling, help me.
It's impossible to shower enough praise on Nancy Wilson. I could read you a lot of different things about her. Let's just suffice to say that she's an unfoxable version of... not only did she handle the American songbook, she handled pop and jazz and rhythm and blues and everything with great alacrity and an inconceivable seeming lack of effort and a dignity and forthrightness and sincerity that's kind of unmatched. If I hate this word, but slightly underrated, maybe because she lived so long and had retired maybe 10 years ago.
Well, so much grace, and she's just a pure song stylist.
She wouldn't have called herself a jazz singer either, I don't think. Just astonishing. Nancy Wilson is forever and lives in the heavens. Speaking of women who did everything they could, let's talk about Penny Marshall for just a second here. I wanted to read a couple things. Penny Marshall did something that not a lot of comedians did. She was a performer who started as a guest star. Did a bunch of shows. Her brother, of course, was a producer of Gary, was a producer of The Odd Couple, who was only the Guardian newspaper and all English publications could say predeceased her. I can't think of a more awful word than that. Mm-hmm. In any case, Penny Marshall and Gary are square dancing in the heavens right now, doing very broad jokes, I presume. And here's what makes Penny Marshall so bitchin' in so many ways. She held down the lead as a star on a 70s and early 80s sitcom. She made a $100 million movie and is the first woman to do so. She was nominated for Best Picture. She might be the second woman next to Lena Wertmüller, who was nominated, I think, for Best Picture as a director. She made a bunch of mainstream comedies and other types of movies, thrillers, whatnot. In a time where it was presumed that only men had that touch, I don't think she took any backseat to anybody as far as if you put Big and League of Their Own, Awakenings and all that up against anybody's oeuvre from then, I think Penny Marshall is an extraordinary comic mind. The thing she put forward is something that people related to. The reason why Big and A League of Their Own are so popular and so enduring is that there's not a lot of bullshit about the comedy. It's sentimental, but in an old-fashioned way that makes it awesome. And there's a melancholy in both of those stories that's undersung. Let's be honest. In Big, he's a child who moves into an adult's job, and then there's that weird sexual part where, like, he might have an affair with Elizabeth Perkins, but they don't. And then in A League of Their Own, which is, and I'm not going to go off about baseball, but I will go off about this. No male director ever thought to make a movie about the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. It took Penny Marshall mm-hmm. to do that. Mm-hmm. It took her with her power after Big to do that. It took her with her power to get Gina Davis, Madonna, Rosie O'Donnell, Tia Leone, that cast of that movie, Laura Padde. They're all athletes. Jennifer and I watched an interview with her, and she said she talked to lots of actresses, and if they didn't know about baseball and they couldn't play baseball, she threw them by the wayside. She said any actress that came in with ballet shoes on or didn't understand what the scope of the picture was out. Gina Davis, Lori Petty, Madonna, Rosie got the idea. You had to be a ball player, first and foremost. You had to understand what that meant. I have no notes about the picture. The only thing I'll say as an addendum and an Eric Estrada is that the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League was not a one-year affair as depicted in the picture. It was an eight-year affair. It lasted a long time, and there was a lot of professional women athletes in the United States, white women, that played in the Midwest in this circuit. Yes, the character that Tom Hanks plays, which follows up his character in Big, who obviously Big was a surprise hit for her, but it made a lot of money, a ton of money, and that's why she was able to make the women's baseball mm-hmm. picture, which no...
But that was hard for her to get going.
Absolutely hard for her. And God bless Tom Hanks for coming in and playing. He's playing an actual ball player named Jimmy Fox, who was an alcoholic and did manage one of the women's teams during that era. And good for him for doing it. It's a picture of sensitivity, but let's get to the chase on it. They don't win at the end. Their league is disbanded. They're not allowed to live their dream. It's on further viewings, it's nostalgic, but it's also not a male. In a male movie, they would win the pennant and there'd be a home run hit and they'd win and the whole thing, and there'd be flags flying and banners flapping and like The Natural and fireworks going off.
And this picture, in The Natural, how old is he?
50. Like, he's 1,000 years old. Welcome to the major leagues, Mr. Hobbs. He's 40. At the end of this picture, they, if you recall, they Schindler's listed at the end, and they all reconvene at the hall where they're given a small exhibit and Dottie's there and whatnot. And all of it's quite true. Quite true. And it's an extraordinary moment, I think, in a lot of ways. Not just because it's a great, it's a comedy movie. It's really funny. There's a lot of great jokes in it. What does Madonna say? What if I slide and my uniform slides down and everyone sees my bosom? And Rosie O'Donnell goes, do you think there's anyone in America who hasn't seen your bosom? And then, they go through all the, how great of athletes they were. They weren't allowed to wear pads. They had to wear skirts. They had to take deportment. All those things are true that are in the picture. They had male groupies, which they sometimes eschewed, because you can imagine during the war. They were also, it's that weird, it's a glorious mixture of the tokenism of World War II, when women were allowed to all of a sudden take over because men were gone.
Mm-hmm.
But also the glory of what women did during World War II. The women were allowed to be professional athletes and they murdered it. Women were allowed to run things and they murdered it. And then men came back. And Penny Marshall's kind of a, if you'll pardon, a terrible metaphor for that. In the 80s and 90s, she murdered it until men came back in and kind of pushed her out a little bit in the early 2000s. I think she's an extraordinary filmmaker for that regard. I think she's an amazing comedian in many ways. I wouldn't go into anything but to say her life is an artistic triumph as a comic. And I think that there's nothing higher you can say about someone like her. Women don't get a chance at the big table, even if they're connected like she was. And she was a little bit connected. And the fact that she made pictures that were so big, and that she made pictures that were nominated for Best Picture.
Well, it's a testament to her power that she stood apart from Rob Reiner, Carl Reiner, her brother Gary.
You think of her separate, and
that's impressive.
The first obituaries bummed me out because it was actress Penny Marshall.
Really?
Yeah, there was a couple that were actress Penny Marshall. And like, yeah, she was a famous actress. She was in The Odd Couple. She was in Laverne and Shirley for 8 years. But no male director,
no,
would they say, no. Ray Stark was an actor or Bob Evans was an actor, which they were.
Right.
Or
Bob Evans, fashion executive.
Right? They would go right to their movie career. And she also made Awakenings with Robin and Robert De Niro. And let's not make a value judgment on the movie or any of the things that happen in the movie. To make a movie about aphasia, to make a movie about Oliver Sacks, to make a movie with two giant stars like that at the time she made it, it's fantastic. And so I'll hear nothing but overwhelming praise. And I meant to play the Madonna song here, but I haven't.
Do you want to cue it up?
All right, I will. All right, I'll spin a little. Penny Marshall, at all events, Penny Marshall brought joy into people's lives. And at the end of the day, there's nothing better. I'll go a step further. She empowered women as an actress, a writer, a director, a performer, and a caster of movies. She made a picture about all women. She made more than one picture about them. And I won't hear anything else. Spaghetti, get over here.
There's no crying in baseball.
There's no crying. Are you crying? I hit 530 home runs for you. There you go. There's a lot here.
Can you see that?
Well, I'm neither.
Let's get to some groovy news. Jezebel, wait, what is this warm, nice feeling in my heart? Some good news. My friends, abortion will be free and legal in Ireland starting in the new year. Once the president signs off on the new legislation, earlier this month, the lower and upper houses of the Irish legislature voted to pass the law allowing a person to seek an abortion in the 12th week of pregnancy. Just fantastic. Will you talk about the Nevada legislature?
It's the first with a majority of women, which means, I think, by one person, but taken all together. In the Senate, there's 23 women.
32 women and 31 men?
Mm-hmm. No, it's phenomenal. And Jackie Rosen was tweeting about that today, what a powerful moment that is, that it's the first time a state has had a majority of women in the state legislature, which is kind of sad that it took till 2018 for that to happen. But I think we're going to see there's a tide and it's everything is changing. One of the women, Rochelle Nguyen, or Wynn, an attorney. She's a criminal defense lawyer, called the milestone fantastic. When women do better, families are stronger. Voters last month elected 30 women and 30 men with three vacancies to be decided. No other state has a legislature where at least half of the seats are filled by women, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. With the two Nevada appointments, women will make up 28.6% of state legislatures legislators nationwide when new legislators are sworn into office in 2019. Women made up 24.3% of state legislators in the U.S. a decade ago. So it's very slow progress. Sometimes dramatic shifts in American politics go unnoticed. They are buried under other news or dismissed because they represent such a sharp break from longstanding assumptions and expectations.
It's extraordinary that at this late date, it's the first time, really,
yes,
that one legislature, and that it's Nevada, which is just fantastic.
Of all places.
Right?
But then the demographics of Nevada have changed remarkably in the last 15 years. I mean, even Hawaii thinks of it as another island.
Right.
There are so many Hawaiians that live in Las Vegas now because of the hotel business in both places.
Yes.
That it's changed the face of politics there.
I think so.
And that's for the better.
Yeah. And having Jackie Rosenwin was really a huge leap forward.
Oh, my God.
The land of Paul Axel. A couple of things here. E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post said, sometimes dramatic shifts in American politics go unnoticed. They're buried under other news. It's because of the bump stock bill. Supporters of reasonable gun regulation have been so cowed by the NRA propaganda over the last 25 years, we're reluctant to even imagine such a thing. No matter how many innocents are slaughtered, no matter how many Americans organize, we assume the NRA and its allies will eventually overpower us. Let's concede up front that the vast overrepresentation of rural states in the Senate tilts the system undemocratically toward those who claim the government. Butina this week, Wyoming and Idaho has been, the bump stock legislation is, I think we're at a tipping point here where I detest the word tipping point or the phrase rather, but I think you're going to see so many people were elected on safe gun legislation and healthcare that this will change.
And what was the number of people that signed off on for affordable healthcare? It was up by 4 million.
And by the way, less glitches. It actually went smoother this time. All the things that the GOP is trying to undermine, health and gun, you know, laws, they're not able to do it all. Margaret Sullivan has said in the Washington Post, it may not be very pretty to hear, but it's undeniable. She was talking about the Kellyanne Conway interview this week with Chris Cuomo on CNN. There was also, subsequent to that, a Sarah Huckabee Sanders press conference where she came out for 10 minutes and tried to lay some lies on the public. And MSNBC in real time cut away from her and fact-checked everything.
Finally.
Well, here's the point. Orange 45 doesn't tell the truth. The falsehood count is over 6,000. And we're up to, what is it called now? An endless pile of Pinocchios.
In Washington Post, yes.
Yes, he simply doesn't tell the truth anymore. The news media continues, even now when it should know better, to be addicted to both sides' journalism in the name of fairness, objectivity, and respect for the office of the presidency. It still seems to take Trump, along with an array of deceptive surrogates, at his word, knowing full well his word isn't good. When major news organizations publish tweets and news alerts that repeat falsehoods merely because the president uttered them, it's the same kind of journalistic malpractice as offering a prime interview spot to Kellyanne Conway. The Literary Hub, Jennifer, hit me to this week. Alexander Heman on the problem with civility. You can go to this. It's on Literary Hub. Alexander Heman is from the Balkans. This is the quotes he talked about. The article is about him being friends with a friend of his who, during the Balkan War, was on the Serbian side and more and more was drawn into their web of fascism. Only those safe from fascism and its practices are likely to think there might be a benefit in exchanging ideas with fascists. It's what we've been talking about on the show since the very beginning and what Jennifer said so succinctly, and I shall repeat here. There's what's right and there's the abyss. There isn't two sides to every story, and there aren't both sides to the Democratic-Republican debate and whatnot. There's fascism, which includes homophobia, transphobia.
Caging children.
Yeah, caging children, misogyny, and absolute terror and hala. And those people don't need to be heard from. You don't need to entertain their opinion. When young children have tattoos written on their arms, when young children are killed for our purposes, when
denied water.
Yeah. It's frightening to think we could be entering the Civil War mode, wherein none of the differences and disagreements can be hashed out in discussion. It's quite possible there's no resolution to the present situation until one side's thoroughly destroyed as an ideological power and political entity. If that is the case, the inescapable struggle requires that anti-fascist forces clearly identify the enemy and commit to defeating them, whoever they are, whatever it takes. The time of conversations with fascists is over, even though they might be your best friend from high school. That I would urge you to read the article on Literary Hub by Alexander Heman, but I want to read you one sentence over again. There's no resolution to the present situation until one side's thoroughly destroyed as an ideological power and political entity. It's not a matter anymore of we have to entertain that they have something to say. The side that thinks that the Syrian war is over with ISIS, the side that thinks that caging babies and killing children is cool, the side that thinks that blocking trans people, the side that thinks that making a Muslim ban is the law of the land, the side that thinks that denying women all of their physical autonomy, the side that thinks that abject racism and is right or has a voice in the land, they're fascists. Mm-hmm. And they don't have to be, not only do they not have to be heard from, let me go further. The time of conversations with fascists is over. You don't have to listen to them. You don't have to entertain them. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Kellyanne Conway, whomever you can think of, whatever surrogates he has, and him, and Pence, and Giuliani, and Miller, and Bannon, and whomever gets to speak forward. Boo.
But also nonsense that you read, and it's really important to support journalists that are doing the good work, like the people at the Fresno Bee who uncovered Devin Nunes's activities, Julie K. Brown at the Miami Herald,
yes.
Jerry Mitchell at the Clarion Ledger, so many local papers who are really trying to uncover what's happening.
There's loads of people out there who are doing the right thing. That's why I don't want to seem like abject, and it's not an all or nothing situation. It's simply that you have to shut down the voices of terror and horror, I think.
Well, and you have to vet. You have to do some research.
The Financial Times named George Soros the person of the year. George Soros was a refugee. George Soros is a philanthropist and humanitarian. He gives loads of money to humanitarian causes. Yes, he's a millionaire. Yes, he's a rich person. Yes, he deals with money and stuff. The Financial Times isn't a left-wing newspaper. The Financial Times is somewhere between Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal.
I loved what they said, though, that about him trying to support democracy.
Yeah.
Especially right now and given what's happening in Hungary.
The anti-Semitism in the world and the anti-Semitism in our government, the anti-Semitism in Hungary, mm-hmm. and he's from Hungary. He escaped from Nazi Germany. He was 14 during the war. I urge you to go to the Financial Times and look up George Soros. He's not the evil person that the media would have you believe. He's, if in fact anything, sort of the opposite of that. People are complex.
Well, but what so much of what this administration does is projection. Whatever they are, they accuse others of being.
The anti-Semitism of this administration is
shocking.
Yeah. Our national security advisor, General Flynn, was in court this week. He is clearly someone who has been a traitor to the United States. Let me read you a little bit from the Washington Post. His defense attorney, Kellner, told the judge he and co-counsel Stephen Anthony were trying to show in their filing Flynn was different from the others who have admitted lying to special counsel, noting that agents did not warn him he was under investigation and he did not have an attorney advising him. But Judge Sullivan rejected that argument, saying Flynn should be held to a higher standard. He was a high-ranking government official advising the President of the United States. I'm not hiding my disgust, my disdain for this criminal offense. Sullivan demanded to know whether prosecutor Brandon von Grack, whether Flynn could have been charged with treason. He appeared to sidestep the question. Later, von Grack told the judge prosecutors did not believe Flynn committed treason. Nevertheless, Sullivan warned Flynn, I can't promise you a sentence that involves no jail time. They came back on that one. Emmett Sullivan was clearly hacked off with General Flynn this week. General Flynn, you may remember, was at the Republican National Convention and took a special delight in harassing Hillary Clinton and said, if I'd done the tenth of what she did, I would be in jail. And led the chant lock her up.
Lock him up.
And now is actually in the position of being, I don't know that he'll be locked up, but obviously the judge was angry with him today and they've moved the sentencing to a later date.
Yeah, but that's on a condition that he is working with them.
And he has been most cooperative
mm-hmm.
of all of them. That's what's weird to me. The New York Times, Facebook deals and data. Facebook's largest partners did more access, got more access than Cambridge Analytica. Facebook never directly told users it was sharing this data. Facebook was sloppy. Regulators let it happen. Jennifer sent me all this today. If you've been thinking about quitting Facebook, you really must and you really ought to. Mark Zuckerberg and all of them are, oh golly, it's just beyond. They don't have anything else in mind but profit and growth. And they've been unregulated up till now. As to the unbelievable depths that they'll present and plumb to use your personal information. There's no regulatory agencies that are holding down Facebook to what it should be held down to.
Well, that's the problem, because it's not going to change until that happens.
However, having said that, we're all going to have the merriest of Christmases. And understand that everything's changing as fast as it possibly can, and that change is good, and that all of the legal system is still operating as it might. And
well, and there are heroes.
There's loads of
like
heroes.
Barbara Underwood and Carl Racine.
Yep.
The attorneys general of D.C. and New York, and there's a very excited dog outside right now.
Totally excited dog outside.
A Christmas dog.
A way excited Christmas dog. We'll be in Florida in January with Drew Carey. I'll be at San Francisco all through New Year's week. The podcast will be on the 30th at the Punchline in San Francisco. We wish you nothing but love and major expectations for the holidays. We leave you with the Kinks, Father Christmas, if it'll play. May every page that you turn be a satchel page. May every bell that you ring be a cool pop bell. And if you have to buy bonds, make sure they're Barry bonds.
But the last time I played Father Christmas, I stood outside a department store. A gang of kids came over.